new shows on the air. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me has moved to 10 a.m., and at 11, we're now bringing you NPR's latest hit, the TED Radio Hour. At 2 p.m., catch the hot news show, Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. Information on the changes are at ktoo.org.
Good afternoon, Juno. It's 2:59 p.m., and it's time for another edition of a Juno Afternoon. What you're hearing behind me is not our familiar theme music. It's actually music played on a dulcimer, and we're going to find out a lot about that with our first guests, Mark Whitman and Barbara Burke, and also talk about the Hearts of the Dulcimer free movie, which is coming up this Thursday, September 11th from 5 to 7. We're also going to be hearing a piece from Mudrooms last year by Rich Forrest, which is called Freeing Willie Sitka Style. And then we're going to talk to some promoters for the season 4 premiere of Mudrooms, which is coming up Wednesday, September 10th. That's tomorrow. And that theme is called On the Water, and we'll be talking with a few people about that. Also on the show, the Juneau School District Representative Adrian Schwartz. She's the food services manager. She's going to talk about the new food services company, Chartwell School Food Service, who will be providing school breakfasts and lunches to students this year. All this, your familiar programs, Bird Note, music, and some more for Tuesday, September 9th, 2014. Stay tuned. National Native News is coming right up.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. At the site of an ancient village in Alaska, archaeologists are racing against erosion to uncover Yupik artifacts. KYUK's Charles Enoch visited the site and has this report.
A cold breeze from the Bering Sea sweeps clouds across a tundra hill upon which sits the ancient village of Agalik. Students and archaeologists are carefully scraping away layers of soil when something catches the attention of the crew.
Hey, Rick. Real pretty.
The abandoned village of Agalik is about 5 miles south of Gwinchak, home of Warren Jones, president of Kanichtok Incorporated, the tribal corporation. There was a sense of urgency in 2009, Jones explains, when people first noticed erosion along the shoreline was exposing artifacts. Jones contacted the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. 5 years later, he says the artifacts are bringing elders' stories to life.
It's like the elders are saying in their own way, we told you so. Now all the little stories are coming alive.
Today there's a show and tell of some of the items excavated from the site at a community building. On display are many variations of household items, tools, and jewelry. Weapons were also found at the site, along with a layer of ash and skeletal remains of humans who seem to have died in an attack. Archaeologists say that it's the first tangible evidence of the Bow and Arrow Wars, or Anguiach Paschatni, as the period is called in Yupik. Anne Riordan was there on behalf of the Chalista Elders Council. With climate change causing erosion across much of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, Riordan says other communities could carry out similar projects, but the clock is ticking.
There's lots and lots of old sites that are being washed away. Many more communities could have this experience.
Back at the dig site, University of Oregon graduate student Anna Sloan uncovers what instantly has everyone at the site smitten.
That is so cool. God.
Yeah,
it's an ulok, a woman's cutting knife with an ivory handle, beautifully carved in the likeness of a mythical sea monster known as the Balrayak. It will travel to Scotland for study and preservation before being returned. Tribal leaders say they will eventually display it. In Bethel, I'm Charles Enoch.
Representatives from tribes across the country are focusing on health issues this week at a gathering in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
My name is Isadora Evanston with the Riverside San Bernardino County Indian Health Board. There was a group of us that decided to come to the conference because National Indian Health Board usually has a lot of information for us to take back to our people.
My name is Jeron. My last name is Whittle. I'm from South Dakota. I live on the Cheyenne River Sioux Indian Reservation. I'm with the Tribal Health Administration. Some of the health issues, we have a lot of high rate of diabetes. We do have programs that are working with the tribal membership.
My name is Wallace Coffey. I'm the chairman of the Comanche Nation tribe. I have many issues that I'm trying to explore. I have a tremendous amount of elders that have hip problems, knee problems, back surgery needs, things like that, and it's just not available for them. We don't have an OBGYN clinic there. We go to another provider for that, and the service is good. But there's nothing like an Indian doctor taking care of an Indian baby. My main objective is to ensure that there's primary care for people in our area.
Federal consultations and listening sessions were held Monday, including with the Indian Health Service. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
Our democracy is a government of the people, for the people. Let's keep it that way. Vote on November 4th. Get registered. Cast your vote. It's that simple. More information at nativenews.net. Brought to you by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And I'm Ken Fix. I'm your host here for a Juneau Afternoon today. With me in the studio, my first guests, which you may have heard one of them playing an instrument at the beginning of the show instead of our usual theme music, Mark Whitman and Barbara Berg are here to talk about the Hearts of the Dulcimer free movie that's coming up at the Douglas Public Library Thursday, September 11th here at 5 to 7 p.m. But first off, let's talk a little bit about this instrument, because a lot of people don't probably know what it is. What exactly is a mountain dulcimer? Because that's the proper term for it, isn't it?
That is the proper term, or Appalachian dulcimer. It's a stringed instrument. It has a total of four strings, but the top two are actually twins, same tone. So it's really just a three-stringed instrument. Some people will call it a lap harp, but it is a blending of a German instrument, possibly.
The current thinking is that historically this comes from something called the Scheithold, which was brought by the Moravian settlers in Pennsylvania, and it was a relative of the German zither, and people played it on a tabletop.
And as early Americans moved down the Great Wagon Road from Pennsylvania to the Appalachian Mountains to Kentucky area, there was a meeting of immigrants. Sometimes at a dance, the Germans would bring their lap harp, and the Scotch-Irish would bring the fiddle, and the lap harp would get scratched up because they were playing a faster music instead of just sitting around the table picking hymns. So they modified it, and the instrument looks like a cross between a fiddle and a zither, or a lap harp.
All right, now I've seen several of these online. They take several different shapes. Think, oh, well, here's a bass. It has pretty much one shape. There really isn't a whole lot of variation in it, whereas the mountain dulcimer, you brought in the case, and I thought you'd brought in a couple of pool cues, because actually it was a rather narrow case, and I thought, well, what's in here? So, yeah. You know, and then you pulled it out, and it's very interesting. It's melodic. It's probably about, 2.5 feet long, got there?
That's about right. It's this one's made of Sitka spruce top, and the rest is black walnut. They come in hourglass shape, teardrop shape, and you can go back and find, as you said, a wide variety.
I have one that's elliptical at home. It has a similar sound, but a little bit not quite as light as the sound of this one.
Yeah.
Those mostly come from some that were developed in Virginia, in the southern Virginia mountains.
All right, Mark, how did you get involved in playing this instrument?
Well, you know, I bought a mountain dulcimer at a garage sale, and it hung it on the wall, and there it sat for 13 years, because I had I would call it a musical prejudice in my mind, in my memory. When I thought of mountain dulcimer, I thought of Jean Ritchie, who's a wonderful singer and player. She's still alive in her 90s. but I largely thought it was just an instrument that you just strummed a chord. And I picked it up to play for a performance. I learned a song on it, and suddenly I realized you can go a lot of places on this, anywhere from Hawaiian to Celtic, finger picking, frailing like a banjo. You can play a Bach on it. Mm-hmm. It's as far as you want to take it, and I just could not put it down.
After leaving it up for 13 years, you couldn't put it
down. I think almost all dulcimer players have a story like that, because there was a big boom in interest back in the 1970s. I bought one here in Juneau in about 1979 from somebody who was selling it at a craft fair at the Nugget Mall. Said her dad in Kentucky made it. I heard it. I just couldn't resist it. I took it home. When my kids were little, I played, strummed some simple songs with them. Then I got busy. I went back to work, and I, too, hung mine on the wall. And then I heard Mark playing a song at a presentation, and I said, "Do you know how to string that? I forgot how to tune mine." And so he showed me, and then I took off, too. I've been obsessed by it. Yeah. For the last 6 months, I've been playing my dulcimer again. It's great.
Okay, and a little bit more about the instrument itself. You'd said it comes in all varieties and sizes, and is there much change in the actual sound of one from, you know, one form to another, as far as, you know, longer ones, shorter ones? So they pretty much carry the same kind of tune, and
it's pretty much tuned to an open chord. Here's this one's tuned to D-A-D. So you've got a, if you can strum three strings, you're already playing the first chord. So as Barbara has a good quote about.
Well, one of the dulcimer experts out there said it takes 5 minutes to learn how to play it and a lifetime to master it.
Yeah.
And that's that's about true.
That's about true. So the sound can vary greatly. And what's really interesting is going from historical models. And as in the film, the Hearts of the Dulcimer, that we'll be showing, it was carried all the way to the West Coast. Of course, everybody knows about Joni Mitchell playing the dulcimer, probably, and Richard Farina, a few may know. Mm-hmm. And but since then, there are people who have been working on dulcimers and refining the building of them to a very high level. It's really impressive what's been done. It's an affordable instrument. I mean, if you can't start off right away with a really nice one, you can get a wood fretboard on a cardboard body for $50. And the sound is exceptional.
It's what it almost sounds like playing a milk jug.
Well, somebody said it really isn't a stringed kazoo. There's more to it than that.
Yeah.
But it's you can get a really good student model from a real reputable maker for about $135-$150, so it's not bad at all. But and then the sky is the limit, like with most other instruments.
Okay, and let's hear a little bit. This is some of the promo that's online for the Hearts of the Dulcimer movie. So let me play just a little bit, and it may get a little bit more people interested here. So let's give a listen to this.
The sound of the dulcimer, it had a combination of the mountain, but also medieval Renaissance. There was that wistfulness that really, really grabbed me.
Thousands of people in the United States who play it, and yet still basically a relatively unknown instrument.
It wasn't very well known outside the folk scene in New York City in the 1940s and 50s, and just certain little pockets within the Appalachian region.
People don't know that there was a big dulcimer boom from 75 into 1980.
The whole dulcimer thing just came to our door. Suddenly we were making a huge amount of dulcimers.
The dulcimer is appealing to the counterculture in California, partly because it represents something that is very different from mainstream, consumerist, materialistic, industrialized America.
We were working together and playing music every day. It was a wonderful time. We were following our bliss.
Yeah.
Big time.
The dulcimer is perceived as having a lot of musical limitations. It has been stereotyped as not very musical. A lot of people take that as a challenge. And so it's fun to try to see how much you can do with this instrument.
We were California hillbillies, not Tennessee or Kentucky hillbillies, so we were doing it the California way.
Okay, that's a little bit of the promotional, the first one for the Hearts of the Dulcimer movie. Can you tell us a little bit about the two people that are involved in making this?
Patricia Delick and Wayne Jiang, they're a couple from California who actually met one another. They were both dulcimer players, and that seems to be a journey that they've continued to follow. They made the movie in 2014. My introduction to them is I was trying to find a picture of Richard Farina, his dulcimer. He was an early folk musician who was down at Big Sur, was married to Joan Baez's sister Mimi Farina, and died very young, but he was a very good dulcimer player. And I found these color photographs of his dulcimer, and it was a picture of these two people who had made the movie. They went all the way to the Smithsonian Institute, had them bring it out so they could make that part of their research in their film. And the more I looked into it, I said, wow, this would be a great movie to show here. I contacted them, and they were very gracious in allowing this free public viewing. They normally charge a lot of money. They're going around the country right now doing this. But they saw that we were sincerely interested in starting a group of people here playing the dulcimer, and they wanted to help with that. And they just did a excellent historical job, the two of them, since it's their passion, of studying the evolution of this instrument, primarily on the West Coast, but they do go back to a workshop in Arkansas, McSpadden Dulcimers, too.
All right, and let's tell everybody when and where the show is going to take place. It's one showing only.
One showing only on the 11th of September from 5 to 7 at the Douglas Public Library.
All right, and this is free.
It is free, and I just wanted to mention, you know, we'll have a dulcimer or two there that you can try strumming. The main reason I play is it is the most relaxing thing in the world to do. I don't know what Barbara's experience is.
Wonderful.
There's something about playing an acoustic wood instrument on your person, on your body. It's nothing downloaded. It's nothing digitized. It's handmade and hand-played. Mm-hmm. And after about a half an hour of playing, it's just the most relaxing thing in the world. It's mm-hmm. just great.
All right. And the website that I've been looking at where I found the clip was Dulcimuse, DulcimuseE.com, where they've got clips promoting the movie. And I believe you can also buy the DVD on the website, too.
That is correct.
Okay. Well, I wish you good luck with this instrument. It's fascinating. So, everybody, it's Thursday night, the 11th, from 5 to 7 at the Douglas Public Library. It is absolutely free. And Mark Whitman and Barbara Berg, thank you very much for being our first guests on the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 9th of September, 2014. It's the birthday of an early writer of the American Southwest, Mary Hunter Austin, born Carlinville, Illinois, 1868. Went to college in Illinois. She was in love with geology, collected fossils. Then she moved out to California and spent most of her life there in the desert on the eastern edge of the Sierras. Studied the geology, the plants and animals, the weather, the native people, and she wrote a book in 1903 called The Land of Little Rain. It was probably her best-known book, but she wrote many others, novels and plays and essays. And it's the birthday of Leo Tolstoy, born near Tula, Russia, 1828, to a noble family, lost his mother as a young boy, but had a pleasant childhood. His father had an extensive library for the boy to read from. He went swimming and sledding and played in the fields and woods at the family estate. After his father died, he went off to university. He managed to teach himself about 12 languages, but he was not so interested in academics, more interested in gambling, drinking, and women. Dropped out of college, spent years visiting brothels and drinking hard and racking up gambling debts. Finally, he signed up for the army at the suggestion of his brother, joined an artillery unit in the spring of 1851. And the following winter, Tolstoy, at the age of 23, wrote his first novel. 1854, he was promoted and sent to the front to fight in the Crimean War, and was horrified by the violence, and also in 1857 by a public execution that he witnessed in Paris. He said, "The sight revealed to me the instability of my superstitious belief in progress when I saw the head part from the body and how they thumped separately into the box. I understood with my whole being that no theory of the reasonableness of our present progress could justify this deed." By 1863, Tolstoy had finished a draft of what would become the first part of a novel he was calling 1805, set during the Napoleonic Wars and the French invasion of Russia. He rewrote, he expanded it, gave it a new name, War and Peace, and it came out in 1867. And 6 years later came Anna Karenina. And it's the birthday of James Hilton, the novelist born in Lancashire, England, in 1900. Published 10 novels in the first decade of his career, didn't get any attention. Then he wrote Goodbye, Mr. Chips, about an old beloved schoolmaster. And when the book came out in the United States, it became a huge bestseller. Followed by another one, Lost Horizon, about an imaginary Tibetan village called Shangri-La. Here's a poem for today by Robert Hass, The Problem of Describing Trees. The aspen glitters in the wind, and that delights us. The leaf flutters, turning, because that motion in the heat of August protects its cells from drying out, likewise the leaf of the cottonwood. The gene pool threw up a wobbly stem, and the tree danced. No, the tree capitalized. No, there are limits to saying in language what the tree did. It is good sometimes for poetry to disenchant us. Dance with me, dancer. Oh, I will. Mountain, sky, the aspen doing something in the wind. The Problem of Describing Trees by Robert Hass from Time and Materials, published by Echo Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
On the next Juno World Affairs Council presentation, Thai activist Sulok Sivaraksa speaks about unrest in Southeast Asia and his experience as a political prisoner.
I was arrested in Ajantia. Many of my students were killed, were tortured, were murdered by the Thai military.
Thursday at 7 p.m. on KTOO and on demand at 360north.org.
It's 3:23 p.m. You're listening to a Juno Afternoon, and this is KTOO 104.3 FM in Juno. I'm Ken Fix. I'm your host. And that was a little blurb about Sulok Sivaraksa, who was my guest on the show last week. Very interesting speaker, and If any of you are interested to seeing him, you can tune in to 360 North for that program. Now, before I bring on Steve Suing and Tom Cosgrove, they are here to promote this season 4 premiere of Mudrooms, which is coming up tomorrow. I'm going to play a segment from one of last year's Mudrooms shows. This will probably lead into what we're going to be talking about here. But this is from October 9th. This is Rich Forrest with Freeing Willie Sitka Style.
The story begins on a sunny afternoon in Sitka. I was mowing the lawn at our house, and my son came up to me and says, "Hey, Dad, there's a whale out there. It's really acting funny." So I look, and sure enough, this whale is breaching in the water and obviously in some kind of distress. So we decide that we'll go out and help this thing. We had a boat in the water at the time, and it had been diving that morning, so all of our dive gear was in the boat. And we wandered down the dock, and my son motored around to the whale there, and I was putting my gear on, and by the time we got there, I had all my gear on, was ready to get in the water. So by now, the whale had settled down a little bit and was just resting in the water. This was a humpback, a full-grown adult. So I got in the water, and I approached this whale from the front of it, so it'd kind of know we were there and maybe have an idea of what was going on. And I got in the water and got down to the whale, and it was like approaching a fuselage of a jet, just huge. And got and saw that there was a line coming from its mouth and around its pectoral fin and down to its tail, and then continue on into the depths of the water. So I didn't want to get around this line too much, so I swam down to the tail and decided, well, I'll go down and see what's down there. I don't want to be messing with this or trying to cut it and have this whale take off with who knows what coming at me in the line. So I dove down to about 60 feet, a depth of 60 feet, and saw that there was a crab pot. And what had happened is this whale was struggling so much that it tangled itself up more, but it also got in a little bit shallower water where this commercial 100-pound pot was now sitting on the bottom. So I can see it just kind of rise up a little bit off the bottom and go down, and a small cloud of silt would be stirred up. Did that a couple times, so I cut it, got that off, and worked my way up the line to the tail. And every 3 feet, I would just make a cut, again, so nothing's behind me. Got up to the tail of this whale, and the line was wrapped about 7 times around the fluke and just embedded in the blubber, obviously very painful. I couldn't get my knife up in there to cut it, so I started to unwrap it. I had to pull. It was really embedded in the skin. And I made a couple laps around his tail, which is about 12 feet, so it's quite a swim, 12 and 12, 24, and that took a little time. I did that 2, maybe 2.5 times and decided, okay, I need to get this off here a little quicker. So I cut and was able to give it a tug a little bit, and I can feel it just kind of on the bone, and I knew it had to be extremely painful. But the whale stayed there and just waited for me to do this. And I was aware of the danger and what could happen, so I was keeping an eye on any movement or anything like that. So I was able to get that off and off its tail. And so now the whale could move a little bit. And it was just now on the surface breathing. So I worked my way to the pectoral fin and slowly cut the line again every few feet. And now there's line just kind of drifting all over in the water, just neutral all around me. And got that off of the pectoral fin and worked my way forward. And now I'm working forward and I'm cutting and cutting. I get closer and I get to the jaw, and first the eyeball and then the jaw. And at that point I realize, okay, you know, this is getting close to his mouth, and all you'd have to do is go like that, and I'd just vortex into him. So for the first, I got a little nervous right then. And then I looked over, and there he is. His eyeball was no farther than this away from me. And I looked him in the eye, thinking, "I'm cool. Are you cool?" And we looked at each other, and the whale, I can tell you, a whale's eyeball is about the size of a softball. And he takes a slow blink, just like that, and back up. And I thought, okay. So I worked my way forward, And I saw that the line, there was a loop going right inside his mouth of about 1-inch line, pretty substantial line. I'd cut the remaining end of the crab pot line off and grabbed this and kind of gave it a tug, and it was really in there. So I hung on to it for a minute, and I put my foot up there, and I just, and I really pulled, and it wouldn't move. And at that point, the whale moved a little bit away from me. And I just reached with my knife, and I put it right under that loop, because I wanted to get that loop cut, thinking, well, it'll slide out at some point. And I was being pulled, and I cut it. I got it off. And then the whale turned, and he came to me, and now I surfaced. And my son had told him, just leave the thing running and be ready to come and get me if I wave. And he came right over, and he's there, and the whale's coming at me. And I put my arms out, not knowing what he's going to do, so I could just be brushed around him. And he came right at me. I had my arms out like this, and he turned a little bit, and pretty soon the pectoral fin came in contact with me, and he just gave me the most gentle but forceful like that, and I was just swept out of the way. My snorkel was flapping in the water, and I bit down on my regulator. The whale surfaced and was breathing and gave out several sounds or grunts about 3 times. So I took my BC and tank off and weight belt and threw it in the small whaler we had at the time and jumped in. And we watched this whale. We followed him for maybe 30 minutes, just really literally off into the sunset. And we later had learned that there was a whale spotted. It would have been about April of the following year in Hawaii with a small amount of line coming out of its mouth. So my son says to me, he goes, Dad, I think we saved him. I says, yeah, I think we saved him. So the whale was literally drowning, and we were able to untangle him, and he survived. So that's my story. Thanks for listening.
Okay, that was from October 9th of 2013's edition of Mud Rooms, which was titled Coming Home. That was the theme, and it was Rich Forrest with Freeing Willie Sitka Style. So now you guys got an idea listening out there what Mud Rooms is about all exactly here. And my guests now in the studio are Tom Cosgrove and Steve Suing, and they're going to be talking about the Season 4 premiere of Mud Rooms, which is coming up tomorrow. I'm pleased to have them in the studio. Welcome, both of you.
Hey, thanks.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So, that was an excellent example of those stories. I mean, what a great story. Rich totally nailed it. I mean, and that's the thing about these stories. You never know who's going to get up there and what they're going to tell. And the bottom line is we all have these great stories. And what's great about Mud Rooms and what has allowed us to do is invite all different kinds of the community to come in and share these unique stories that otherwise you would never have heard. And I tell you what, we've learned some interesting things about our friends and neighbors, who's been in the circus and different things. So it's a great thing. So Mud Rooms is, like you said, we're starting our fourth season this tomorrow night, and it's been a wonderful success. Just to give you an overview is Mud Rooms, we say real people, real stories. 7 people, 7 minutes, 7 stories. Every month there's a theme. People get up and share their story.
All right, so this one that's coming up is called On the Water, which this actually would have fit in really good with On the Water.
Sure it would.
All right, and who are our speakers that are coming up for the first edition of Mud Rooms?
Well, first of all, I wanted to say, want to introduce Steve. Steve is our newest board member. I'm a member of the Story Board, one of the folks that put on Mud Rooms every year, and we were lucky enough to snag Steve into our group.
Happy to be here. Really excited to be part of this group. Like most people, I enjoy a good story. I enjoy telling a good story and listening to a good story. And after a couple of times attending Mud Rooms, I decided that's something I could do. So I told a story, and opportunity came to be a part of the storyboard, and I was more than happy to jump in with this group and be a part of this event that happens.
What was your story? Remind us.
My story was awkward. And it was about my father and mother meeting in northern Idaho. And my mother came from European descent and by all means would be considered white. And my father came from the Caribbean. So about their meeting in the 1970s in northern Idaho was my story. I'm happy to introduce this event for coming up tomorrow. That's at 7 o'clock at Northern Lights Church. The theme, once again, is On the Water. And that's the great thing about the themes we choose. They're kind of general, so you can approach them from any level that you're comfortable with, and that applies. And our speakers are going to be Senator Dennis Egan, Michael Patterson, Giselle Storm, Liz Villanova, Chip McMillan, Phil Merrill, and Rebecca Braun. And each of the events, we try to have some music as well, some music before and during the intermission. And this month's music will be provided by Travis Smith, co-owner of the Rookery and a big supporter of Mudrooms. Our first Mudrooms event happened at the Rookery. I'll give you some idea of kind of the upcoming topics that are coming up. We've got next month, Small World, Sibling Rivalry, Accidents Happen, Rearview Mirror, Trains and Automobiles, Brush with the Law, that should be interesting, First Job, Worst Job, and then we end with a nice crescendo in May with Poop, Parasites, and Pest. So we've got a nice lineup of topics.
I saw that on the upcoming promotion. I'm like, okay, that's going to be rather interesting when they do
well,
that
one. Well, believe it or not, I want you to know that there is only one spot left in that particular one, and we've got other spots open, and that's something I want to put out there. We would love to have you tell a story, whoever you are. And look at get online, take a look at our list there, because I know somebody's got a story about Brush with the Law.
Yeah, that's... I don't think I've got a good Brush with the Law story, but if you ever do a show like that's all about air travel and air traffic controllers, if you do one called Up in the Air, I would probably be able to tell a really good one.
Okay, we'll pencil you in.
You pencil me in for that one. All right.
The one other thing I wanted to add is that it is $7 charge to get in the door, and all this money passes through directly to nonprofits in the community. And once again, we're starting season 4. But to date, we've raised over $21,000 that's passed through to nonprofits in our community. And this event specifically is going to go directly to the Northern Lights Church for the roof project that they've just undertook and are close to completing. They've been very gracious hosts to the Mud Rooms program, and this is a way of saying thank you and kind of giving back for what they've given us.
And so if you haven't heard about the Northern Lights roof project, it started out to be a roof replacement. It turned out to be just some shingles, and it turned out to be major rot. It's a huge project, and they have been, they're great in a community about supporting the arts. And so I happen to know, I was just over there, and they told me they've got a $25,000 challenge grant happening right now. So for every dollar they get, they can get a match. And they are at 11th and B.
All right. Well, you have anything else to add, Tom, for the show coming up?
Well, for the show coming up, I don't know. Every show is unique. There's always some kind of surprise. You walk away with something like, wow, that was interesting.
Yeah, so On the Water is the theme for this one that's coming up. This is the season opener. How did this get started in Juneau? We need to backtrack just a little bit. Who came up with the idea for this?
Well, this is something that's happening nationwide. There are events all over the U.S. The Moth is something that started out in New York a few years ago. Arctic Entries in Anchorage. Chicago has Second Story. And so 4 years ago, Amanda Compton and Alita Buss were the leaders in putting it together. And now it's run by a team of people that... believe that this is a real positive thing for our community.
Okay, and how do you vet the speakers that are coming up for the shows?
We ask them, do you want to do it? And they say yes.
That's it. Do you want to do this? Uh-huh. Yeah, I think I got a good story.
And I think that, you know, we talked to them about story, and we've talked individually with a number of them. Well, what story should I use? But a lot of people hear a theme, and they know. They got, oh. I got this story. It reminds them of the story, and that's really and so those aren't people you really need to vet. So.
Okay. And is there a little bit of colorful language used in these shows? Or
absolutely not.
Absolutely not. Okay.
Occasional stray word here and there, but
for the most part, it's good, clean fun.
Oh yeah,
and
family
good storytelling.
Friendly.
Okay, yeah. Great. All we're missing is a campfire.
Exactly right.
I think the exciting thing about it is it's a wide representation of Juneau. from the young to the old, and all sorts of people. So I think in terms of connecting people, it's one of the events that draws a wide range of people interested for various reasons. Could be the theme, or it could be the speaker that night, or it could be they're just interested in mudrooms.
All right. Again, it's tomorrow night, and Tom, highlight once more the venue. Where is this going to be?
It's going to be at Northern Light United Church at 11th and B, downtown Juneau at 7 p.m., and I suggest getting there early. We have been regularly filling up the entire sanctuary of the church and run over into the back, so come early.
All right. Fabulous project. Steve Sewing, Tom Cosgrove, thank you so much for being my guests on the show.
You bet. Thank you.
And earlier on Fresh Air, they were talking with Bob Gaudio, who is the songwriter for the Four Seasons. And I'm going to play one song out of Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons repertoire. This is December in 1963.
Hour in the United States, one person dies from mouth cancer. Tobacco use has been linked to mouth cancer as well as tooth decay and tooth loss. Quitting tobacco will improve the health and appearance of your mouth, gums, and teeth. Quit tobacco today and have something to smile about. Brought to you by the Partnership for a Tobacco-Free Southeast, SEARCH, and Alaska's Tobacco Quitline. You can quit. We can help. 1-800-784-8669.
Support comes from Valley Medical Care, offering a team of physicians and nurse practitioners committed to healthy newborns, toddlers, teens, and adults in Southeast Alaska. and proud to support public radio.
It's 3:43, and you're listening to KTOO in Juneau. I'm Ken Fix. I'm your host for a Juneau afternoon. My last guest in the studio today is Adrienne Schwartz, and she's the new Juneau School District Food Services Manager. She's going to talk about the new food service company, and it's a pleasure to have her in the studio with me.
Well, thank you for listening. One thing that I should clarify is that I have actually been working for the school district for a while as the food service supervisor, but we do have a new company that we're working with, Chartwell School Dining Services, and we also, along with that, have a new food service director. Her name is Joni Clark. She's very busy right now since it's the beginning of the school year, so she was not able to make it here with us today. But I think we wanted to talk a little bit about the nutritional pieces of our program and some of the new things that we're highlighting.
Certainly. Go ahead.
Okay. So with Chartwell School Dining coming in, they focus on making this experience fun for our students. So they have some concepts that they have brought with them. At the elementary level, they know that students like bright colors, stimulation, and fun, so they've built the dining experience around that. So as parents and students and other community members visit our elementary schools, you'll notice that our dining rooms are a little bit more bright and colorful than they were in the past. We're working on a contest to name that cafe with student prizes and things like that to give the students more ownership over their dining area, make it a little bit more personal and more fun for them.
All right, and let's talk a little bit about content of food that's being served, what kind of dishes are coming up, and also the costs for students.
Okay, so the cost is the same as it was the last two school years. We chose not to increase the cost. So we are charging $3.50 for a student meal, for a lunch, and $1.75 for a breakfast. Now, with that meal, the lunch meal, for example, you get an entree, as many different choices as you would like to select from our fruit and vegetable offering bar. It's similar to a salad bar, just a little bit smaller. And then a milk. So that's what a student would get for the $3.50 for a lunch. The breakfast is similar in that you receive three items. And then you did ask about what types of items we're serving. So every day at breakfast, we are offering either a cold cereal or a hot entree. The hot entree changes every day, but we know that sometimes students may not want to choose the hot entree we have, so then we have a variety of cereals that they can choose from. Lunchtime, at the elementary level, there are three entrees that students can choose from each and every day. So, for example, tomorrow we have baked breaded Alaskan pollock nuggets, and we have that comes with a whole wheat roll or a chicken quesadilla. And then there also is the choice of an Italian hoagie sandwich. And then, of course, those come with some other items, fruits and vegetables and so on, and a milk. At the high school level, they've really stepped it up, and they have a whole concept now that they brought in that's a food court style. And so the students at the high school and middle school level actually have the ability to go to these different stations. They're becoming familiar with what they are, and they're themed stations. So we have a create station where students can go and actually create their own food. Because we're federally regulated, there's portion sizes that you have to deal with, so there is actually somebody there telling what they would like put on their burrito, but they're building it themselves. So that's the create station, and it's not just burritos. There's Asian rice bowls, different types of pasta. There's also a so deli station where they can, same kind of concept. There's some deli meats and cheeses and different veggies, and they can tell the person there what they'd like on their sandwich. Box salads at that station. We have a tomato station with pizzas, like every different kind of variety of pizza, and then a grilled station that has your typical, you know, burgers and chicken with sides of fries and tater tots and those kinds of items.
All right, and how does this menu fit in with nationally mandated nutrition requirements?
Well, It seems to be working out really well. I've worked closely with our new director. She moved up here the middle of July. She was actually managing a rather large, quite a bit larger school district in Washington State. So she has a lot of experience. And what they do, this company has their own registered dietitian and a chef dedicated to our region, and I think our region includes Alaska and Washington, Oregon, you know. But so all of the menus that are put out are designed by those folks to make sure that they meet the USDA National School Lunch and Breakfast Program requirements. And so I've been really impressed when we've asked for nutritional information. You know, we're able to get it immediately. And so I feel very confident that we're meeting those program requirements and in a fun and appealing way for students.
All right. And how does Chartwell's compare to our previous food services company?
Well, you know, I really would like to say that our previous food service company brought us leaps and bounds from where we were before. Because I came on that first year with the previous food service company, but I had reviewed the program the spring before, and we had foods made off-site, and they were sack lunch-type style food, and so we weren't serving at all from our kitchens or in our right there on site.
So you weren't using the resources that you had.
Yeah, we weren't using the resources we had. Thank you for helping with that.
Oh, I don't mean to take your thunder away.
No, that's okay. And so I feel like our previous food service contractor brought us leaps and bounds from where we were, but then that's happening again with Chartwell's. They're bringing us a step forward, and the students have been just thrilled. The staff has been thrilled. I've been visiting schools every day and have just had compliment after compliment. And I think that, you know, we're only going to continue to see improvement.
Okay. Did they have somebody that came up in advance and took a look at what preparation facilities were available and worked everything in based on what they saw that you had available? Right?
Yes. They have a team that, a regional team, and they've been very dedicated. And I believe there's been five folks on that team, their registered dietitian, their chef, their marketing director. They have a regional director, and then the gal that they hired for to be the director of our district. And even this summer, they sent a director from an Oregon district up here for 5 weeks to help get things up and running.
All right. Well, it sounds like they've got everything under control here. And the menus sound pretty good. Makes me a little hungry listening to that. All right. All right, Adrienne Schwartz, thank you so much for being our guest on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
This is Bird Note.
Yeah? Did you see him?
Yep. We're at the Boat Pond in New York City's Central Park to meet an individual who enjoys a million-dollar view from his home atop a co-op building on Fifth Avenue. It's the country's most famous red-tailed hawk, Pale Male, imaginatively named because he's A, unusually pale, and B, male. Bird lovers in New York City keep close tabs on Pale Male. Books have been written about him. Blogs track his every doing. Each day, spotting scopes and cameras follow him all around his domain. And he's a remarkably resilient fellow. Pale Male first set up house in this high-rent neighborhood in 1992, 2 years after he hatched. He's been living off pigeons and other city wildlife, producing young off and on ever since. In a city that holds many dangers for birds, Pale Male has outlived several mates. One bird, Chocolate, died after a collision with a car. First Love died after eating a poisoned pigeon. Others perhaps ate poisoned rats, a real problem for urban birds. Yet still, in 2013 and 14, Pale Male nested successfully with Octavia, his eighth mate. Learn more about Pale Male and the problem of rat poison for these birds and others at our website, birdnote.org.
PM, you're tuned to KTOO in Juneau. Today's forecast, rest of the day, sunny skies. Wow, this is amazing. Becoming partly cloudy this evening with lows in the upper 30s to low 40s and southeast winds at 10 miles an hour. And tomorrow, becoming mostly cloudy with a slight chance of rain in the afternoon with highs in the low 60s and southeast winds at 10. But because such a nice day exists today, I'm going to play a little bit of Electric Light Orchestra's Mr. Blue Sky. That's Electric Light Orchestra with Mr. Blue Sky from the Out of the Blue album. That's always a great song to play, and hardly ever a day in the summertime when we get blue skies in Juneau. Well, it wasn't this summer anyways. I'm Ken Fix. I've been your host for a Juneau afternoon today, and I'm going to be on vacation next week, so somebody else will be filling in for me on Tuesday. And I will see you, though, the week of the 21st. I will be back on the air on Tuesdays and looking forward to spending time with all of you listening out there. Hope everybody has a wonderful day. What's next? All Things Considered on NPR is coming up in just a few moments.
KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We rebroadcast on translators K276 AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269 AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K201 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Hoonah, and K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Well, now there's no